Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard to live it, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I thought I could last for long. But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Friday night segment of Let's Talk Fort Worth. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. A reminder, we do not own the rights to the music you just heard. Also, we're going to ask you to please click that share. Tell someone Let's Talk Fort Worth is on the air, and we're about to discuss the topic, should we police our own community? That's what we're talking about tonight. Should we police our own community? In 2019, there were 70 homicides in Fort Worth. There were also 9 police shootings, of which 7 were fatal. The 7th was a Tatiana Jefferson. After that, people of all races poured into the city council chambers week after week saying, we do not feel safe. They were referring not to the 70 homicides, but to the 9 police shootings. That said, again, should we be policing our own community? With that being the foundation for tonight's show, let me open the phone lines for my panel. Tonight we have Eddie Griffin. He's a community activist and creator of the Policing 101 Manual. Also, we have Dr. Murray Fortner. He's the founder of a nonprofit called Focus, as well as a professor for TCC. We also have Rashonda Mays. She worked for the Coming Up Gang Intervention Program here in Fort Worth, and she also worked for TCAP, where she was working with the juveniles who were being released on cases. And last but not least, we have Reggie Ruffin. He's executive director, social activist, and investigator for a nonprofit called Just Cause Coalition. Okay, y'all, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Let's Talk Fort Worth.
Greetings.
Good evening.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. Y'all heard the intro about, you know, what happened in 2019 and how, despite the fact there were 70 homicides in the city, there were also 9 police shootings, and of which 7 of those were fatal. And the 7th, of course, was that of a Tatiana Jefferson. And I watched people go to the city council week after week, grown men, women, you know, saying to the city council they did not feel safe. So if that is the case, should we be policing our own communities? We'll start with you, Rashonda.
It's kind of a bit awkward because I am on the Southside area, and, of course, I worked at Hillside for almost 10 years providing mm-hmm. services. So I live literally up the street from where she was murdered, and our houses are almost identical because I decided to come and get a house back where I was raised. So you asked, do I feel like we should police our communities? I came up in an era where gang violence and murders were very, very bad when we were known as Fort Murder Works. And I watched different programs come in to help individuals in the community try to help others in the community to kind of decrease gang violence. And it worked at the time. And once those programs deceased, of course, crime rose. So, of course, I'm definitely for us policing our own communities, as we should.
Wow. Eddie Griffin, is policing our own communities a good idea?
Yes, policing our community is a good idea. In fact, whenever the cops are not around, who do you think keep an eye on the community? It's us in the community who are active and actively watching for our neighbors.
Okay, all right. Okay. Dr. Fortner, should we be policing our own community?
Could you give me a little more in terms of what you refer to as policing? There is an informal policing and then there's a formal policing. Are you talking about just in terms of being vigilant as it relates to crime, or are you talking about the police force in terms of black officers policing black neighborhoods?
I think what when I'm hearing the term, I think what I'm hearing is that people are saying we should do away with police coming into our communities, period, and that we should then be policing our own community. So, you know, there's certain affluent areas like downtown. Okay, somebody's got some noise in their background, and if you would isolate the noise. And by that, you'll probably need to mute yourself when you're not speaking. Okay, with that said, like there's sections of downtown Fort Worth where the Basses have their own police force. So should we have similar things in our own community?
I think we should. We've always done that. We've always had that. We've always had when it was grandpa or the old person on the stoop. Watching and keeping up. We've always had that, but I think we shouldn't lose sight of the notion that we don't want to focus so much on the symptoms and overlook the cause. We need to also get at the cause as to why we have so much going on in our community that it requires us to have so much policing. But yes, indeed, I do think that we should have an element that will police ourselves.
Mr. Ruffin, should we be policing our own community?
Well, you know, as we were just speaking about momentarily, that depends on how you want to define. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like the saying about defunding the police. I mean, are you talking about just taking away money from the police where the police got to pay for their own ammunition, their own car, their own gas and everything to patrol? Or are you talking about taking a more proactive approach toward how we police things in the community? Gallup is a city that averages over 500,000 911 calls every year.
Mm-hmm.
There's only 3,500 cops that we know of that's in Dallas right now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could eliminate half of these problems, the problem, so when people just calling in for petty issues that can be handled amongst themselves without having to go through the extent of putting the police in, that could be a form of self-policing. The other thing is, however, is if there is a problem in the neighborhood, speaking up about it. I mean, police want us to tell on each other when something's going on in our neighborhood, but when one of them do something wrong, they don't tell upon, they don't tell on each other when their partner's breaking the law, violating people's rights, and you know, and hurting someone or even killing. So,
okay.
So I think we have to definitely be a little bit more cogent about how we're stating what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish, because we're going to need police no matter what.
I think when I hear the term of policing your own community, I think it sounds like a desperate I should say it's out of desperation, where the people feel like the current police, a lot of people say the current police state that we're in right now is not working for us, and that we are, you know, putting ourselves in jeopardy. Or in danger, I guess I should say, every time we call the police, because in many cases, I can call the police about my neighbor who may be threatening my life, and sometimes I may end up being the one that's killed. So Mr. James is on the phone. Mr. James was the person who called the police for Tatiana Jefferson that night. Mr. James, you know, and maybe he'll talk to us tonight, but it was a welfare check. And the welfare check, you know, ended up turning into something that was never intended to be. It was just was supposed to be the officers going to make sure that everything was okay because the doors and windows were open. And that's it. So we're not where we are today feeling that we can trust the police to come in and handle matters for us. It feels like when we call them that they quickly escalate the situation a lot of times, and people end up dead. So I think when people are saying they want to police their own communities, it's because that's happening way too often, and so people are wanting now to figure out a way in which they can handle those calls themselves as opposed to bringing the police in at all. Is that not something that you all feel could work?
That would depend on, that's on a case-by-case basis. I would base it on who the individual is, what the situation is, or what's concerning.
Okay, let's go here. You brought up defunding the police. Defunding the police, I found out, means something different to every person you ask about the term. You may say defunding the police to one person, and they may be defining one thing, and then you say defunding the police to somebody else, and they mean something totally different. So to you all, what does the term defunding the police mean? And with that, should or should not we be doing that? Eddie Griffin, I'll start with you. We did this on another show, and we were totally blown away about the responses that people had to the same question. So, Eddie, should we be defunding the police?
The thing it is that it is a slogan that has become propagandized.
Mm-hmm.
We are not saying that we don't need the police to abolish the police. Mm-hmm. We are saying that in a neighborhood like mine,
mm-hmm.
we don't need 10 squad cars cruising up and down the street 24/7, because most of the time they don't have anything to do except racial profiling. This phrase, defunding the police, meant absolutely nothing to us when it was first shown on Fox News. They found the guy at George Floyd's Black Lives Matter protest, sitting in the grass all by himself, had a sign that said, defund the police. Well, I knew that was not our young people that coined that phrase. But Fox News played it over and over and over again until it became a hot topic, hot and controversial topic. So when they say defund the police, the person who says it needs to define what do they mean by defund the police. Now, I admit that I got in front of the phrase and tried to change the implications of anarchy. Mm-hmm. I tried to say, well, look at the police fund, the police budget. Percentage of the budget goes to the police. And we find out that they are getting a larger and larger piece of the pie of our city budget. And they feel like, of course, the cops are going to always feel like it's justified. They need this. But you don't need to have 10 squad cars in my little neighborhood. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
They can save a whole lot of money.
I agree. And it does, it seems like that doesn't happen in other neighborhoods when you call the police. Or if it is, it's a case of a standoff, and they'll be there all night trying to talk the person out of the situation, whereas when they come to our community, they come 10 deep and the matter's resolved in an hour and somebody comes out in a body bag. But I'm not going to go there. I didn't even mean to go there. Dr. Fortner, define defund the police, and should it not be happening?
Just from my point of view, I just see it as reallocation of funds. And police, just like the United States military, a large part of your federal budget is always going to go towards the military. Large part of city budget is going to go because people believe in safety. But the whole notion of how that term sort of took on its own life is in part the responsibility of an irresponsible media. But the way people perceive it, there are a whole bunch of terms like that that are phrases that seem to incite people to come up with ideas that will allow them to go anti to sometimes what is right. I don't even use the term affirmative action anymore. People seem to take that as I'd say affirmative opportunity. There's a whole bunch of things that we have to, language is that important. We have to figure out a way to package it in a very, very different kind of way. But back in part to your first question, I'm not in favor of, people pay taxes. So we shouldn't have let the police run away from their responsibility. You have black people who are city councilmen. You have black people who have important positions within police departments. These people have to be responsible, and they have to make sure that the training and all other aspects are such that we don't have to go to defunding. We don't have to go to should we police our own. There, it's in place there. We just have to make sure that the people who are in those positions, that we have sustained pressure on those people to do what we put them there to do. And if we can do that, then I think, you know, I don't think we should adopt a model where black people must do this, white people must do this. One of my favorite sociologists, William Julius Wilson, always talks about interracial coalitions. No more of the black people do this, white people. We live in a society together, but we have to make sure that the people who have positions, we force them to do what they have to do. And if you have a police officer who is bad, we get rid of that police officer. They have to have mechanisms where they weed out bad apples. We can't keep running away from the real issue because we got police forces in place. We need to make sure we clean them up because we do something else, bad police officers are still going to be there.
Rashonda, what is your definition of defund the police, and should we or should not we be doing it?
I want to piggyback on something that he said. He said something about reallocating funds. So when I hear the word defund police, although I've heard numerous definitions of what it might mean to someone, but to me what I see it as is, like I said, reallocating funds. The city of Fort Worth gets this year, their fiscal budget was $1.8 billion. Out of that $1.8 billion, $337 million of that went to Fort Worth Police Department for them to allocate those funds however they choose to. It also showed that the last 5 years, although they get $200-plus million in their budget, they always go over at least by 20% or more. They also get other special fundings as well that's located in the budget. So they get a nice chunk of change, you know, to do a job. And as a taxpayer, you know, me paying taxes and being a homeowner, I would think that we need to reallocate funding to be used appropriately. I mean, look at Tarrant County. A few of their constables got in trouble because they was abusing the system by working overtime hours that they never even worked. And, of course, City of Fort Worth fell under the same thing, but they tried to sweep that under the rug. So, yeah, I think that we should defund police. Unless a budget, maybe, will make them straighten up and realize that they're going to have to work hard for their money just like everybody else.
Gotcha. You know, a lot of times in these police shootings, people will say, we need better training. We need better training. We need better training. That's the solution to stop these police shootings. But if it were just about training, I think we had a situation in Flower Mound this week where three officers were shot, but the person who did the shooting, he walked out of there. And so in the case of, you know, when they come into our community, you'll see someone running away and they get shot in the back, or you'll see someone with their hands up and they still get shot. So is it really about training, or is something else going on, Reggie Ruffin?
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on, and I guess you can call that a difference with a definite distinction that we're discussing. One of the biggest problems is most of these laws that they have now, while they talk about reforming the police, the laws are already on the books. Police cannot be doing the things they have gotten away with. Problem is, we're living in a society now where we're ruling everything on the matter of personal opinion and not by the rule of law. And I brought this up with you the other day when I was talking about how, you know, police have come over to my house just to, you know, mess in my personal business. That had nothing, it wasn't nothing illegal about it or anything. They just tried to make it illegal, like they made a big deal about my cars. And then they ended up filing false reports and taking them. That's illegal. Police are not allowed to file false reports to seize property. They then turn around and sell it. Then you have the city that covers them and enables them to do these things, making all types of, you know, provisions. And things. We as blacks need to learn the law a little more to know what they can't do to us, as opposed to what they do to us and feel like they can get away with it. Because there are so many things, and like Lee Merritt has definitely made it. That's one of the things I love about Lee Merritt is how he's come in here and has gotten a lot of these things straight. But, I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg, needless to say, because for every 2-3 case you see where we're actually prosecuted and something was done, you have tens of thousands that fall away, never get to see the light of day. Just like Ronald Green, how he got murdered, and literally murdered, and nothing was done. But let's not be mistaken. He's not the only one. There's probably someone getting murdered right now that we don't know nothing about, and won't know until they bring this out to the light, to the public. And we have a long way to go on all this. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we definitely do, we need to hold our city leaders accountable. Because they'll come to everyone's church, barbecue, dance, everyone wants to do the name and the macaroni, all that other stuff. But at the end of the day, you need to go down there and talk to your city council person or your mayor and whomever else. And sometimes they are black. Sometimes they're, but at the end of the day, green is the only color they're seeing.
Gotcha. Dr. Fortner, when you see a situation where, you know, a young black man is you know, being arrested in some kind of way with no weapon in his hand and with his hands up, he's still shot dead, and then you see a situation where, you know, a white person has assault weapons and he's shot three or four people, and they take him to McDonald's or Burger King, Wendy's, wherever they took him to before they arrested him and took him off to jail. Is it about training or is something else going on?
Now, when I say training, I always look at it this way. It's not just training. It's training is just in addition to a lot of other things. When I see that happening, I'm never surprised because keep in mind, black people have always been considered menaces to society. And what we're talking about is a police problem. This is an America problem. I mean, this is happening in schools. We have isolated the police, but these are things that are happening in all other sectors of society. Black people are being treated in a different kind of way. Even trying to buy a home, I saw an article the other day. The lady had somebody else come sit in the house who was white so that she could get it appraised higher. So this isn't just a police problem. It's an America problem. And how we get change, and we can talk about police, but when it comes to the black community, the big problem is we don't know how to put sustained pressure on American institutions in the way that we did, as I spoke to you at one other point, in the way that we did in the 1960s, because we have isolated incidents where people will try to get change as opposed to a coalition of institutions within communities like we did in the 1960s. The biggest group, from my point of view, who seems to drop the ball is the black church. Calvin Butts said that the black church, there is no separation between church and state. If we want to see a lot of these problems addressed, not necessarily changed, but addressed, it has to be sustained pressure. The policing issue that we're talking about now, where's the coalition of black pastors who put pressure on politicians, who put pressure on systems and force change? The most we've ever had was the made-for-TV movement, Black Lives Matter. We need grassroots sustained movements coming out of black churches, black colleges, black media, real movements that put constant pressure. They have to approach these things on a common agenda, and they have to stay on it, not here one week, off one week. These are problems that plague the country in all sectors, not just the police. So a bigger problem is we have weaknesses within our own community that's not doing the things that we need to do to put the necessary pressure on the people that we should.
Gotcha. Yeah. Rashonda.
Let's make a distinction.
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead, Eddie.
Let's make a distinction between Fort Worth and Chicago. Fort Worth is not Chicago. We just, not too long ago, got $6 million grant from the Department of Justice to address community policing. Mm-hmm. Chief Joel Fitzgerald, created a procedural justice training program that emphasized de-escalating and other techniques that reduce police confrontation and violence between the citizens and the police.
Mm-hmm.
We loved it. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Sunshine. What's her name? Sunshine? Rolled it out into the community. I don't know how many people attended the training program, but I saw it before it was rolled out, and I thought it was great. But the police officers themselves were the ones that was against that training program. And and there was a department that was dedicated to procedural justice. I don't know how it's operating now, but if they got rid of the training program, they probably got rid of that department. Did have the training program because we did have the money from the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Rashonda, is it about training or something else?
As someone who actually work in HR on the civil service side of the hiring with Tarrant County, not only will I say that it is training, I also will say that it has a lot to do with who you're hiring. For example, most of them are supposed to get psychological evaluations, for example. In my opinion, the psychological exam should be a little bit more stringent, and it should have certain questions pertaining to what have you been exposed to in your life, because what you've been exposed to in your life is going to determine how you do your job. A good example of that is, let's just say, you know, you grew up in the TCU area. Well, we know if you grew up in the TCU area, you got a little bit of money, right? You're pretty wealthy if you go to TCU and you even live in that area, right? So 9 times out of 10, you probably haven't even been exposed to anybody that grew up on the South Side, Stop 6, Como, or any other, you know, black predominant neighborhood, or even Hispanic or any other minority for, you know, that point. And so then you turn around and you still hire this person. You're hiring a person, and not only are you hiring them, but then you turn around as a rookie, you turn around and put them right in an area and around people that they've never been exposed to. Questions that you should have asked from jump. Who have you dealt with? Who are you? What have you encountered in your life? That should determine what area that they put you in, or even if they should even hire you at all, period. Because a lot of them are racist, and some of them will tell you straight out, they don't care about you, what color you are, anything else. They're going to continue to treat you like how they are because that's how they were raised. So to me, I feel like it's more so who you hire and how they hire. When Fitzgerald was here, one of the things that he wanted to do was he wanted to change how they hire forward police. One of the things he had added in was psychological evaluation. When I spoke to him one time in Dallas, he agreed. He said, you know, the trainings that we do are minimal. They don't learn much because they basically expect you to know everything when you get there. I mean, they don't make that much money. So without the experience, what do you expect? So, yes, I'm going to say it has a lot to do with who you hire and what type of background. I mean, a background check is nothing. A psychological issue or knowing how someone was brought up could play a huge part in how they treat people.
Agreed. Absolutely agree. Listen, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Let's Talk Fort Worth. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Our topic tonight is, should we be policing our own community? Our guest tonight is Rashonda Mays, Eddie Griffin, Reggie Ruffin, and Dr. Murray Fortner. If you'd like to chime in on tonight's topic, the call-in number is 516-387-1981, and then press 1. We're going to the phone line, y'all. We're going to pick up 702-557. Good evening. I just lost you on the board. Oh, there we go. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Dr. Asani. And this is a very interesting topic. Hi, how you doing, Carrie? Good. I'm doing well. And, of course, this is a very pertinent topic. And I think that after listening to the callers and teaching criminal justice and going to a lot of conventions and conferences from 20, 30 years ago, the points that everyone has brought up are correct. As far as that there's a problem with translating police behavior in the black community. And it's also a problem of us figuring out how to correct it. And in this case, we have a brain aneurysm, which is a rupture in the brain that causes bleeding. And in our case, it causes us not to undergo all the way to the conclusion of community policing. In my experience, the best way to community police is to separate the policing, because the behavior of American police cannot be reformed. And this is not just my opinion, but it's been formed by so many other doctors in the field of criminal justice. Because, as one of the sisters say, when you do the psychological makeup of the police department, you have to go all the way back to how they were raised. And in this, and another brother explained that it goes all the way back to how you're brought up. And how we're brought up in America is a very divided country as far as race relations is concerned, and everybody knows that. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion should be, and this is where we have the brain aneurysm, the conclusion is to form not coalitions, not expected to come out the church, but to form a more suitable and powerful structure to be able to separate our communities. And when I say separate, they're already separated, but when I talk about separation, I'm talking about the actual political separation that would allow us to have our own police and our own stores, our own banks, our own schools, because it goes all the way back to the societal understanding that we have to protect our own people. And this only comes about when we tribalize our areas based upon our own ethnic identity. This is called political identity politics. The white people use this type of politics. We just don't realize that all American politics is political identity politics, ethnic politics, based upon your own special interests. So the conclusion is that we should realize that we should form our own councils, our own governance councils, and then and we can do this because we have a status in America as Afro-descendants and as indigenous people, and the indigenous people in this country have their own police, and they have less problems with them getting their members of their tribe shot and killed because they're being policed by their own tribal members. We have to be policed by our own tribal members because we cannot, and as you know, and as everyone in this call knows, we are looking at the results of not doing this. And as you said, Carrie, what can training help? No, because it doesn't go deep enough. Can psychological testing help? Not really, because of the fact that it goes so deep into the society, it goes all the way into how we were raised from the time when we were born and the time that they were born. So we have to realize that we have to go and tribalize ourselves. And we can do it because we have the right to self-determination. That's all of American communities are doing it. So in Fort Worth, what I would suggest is that you hold a conference, a convention among yourselves, and elect your own tribal council or your own council. This council will have, in law, enough power to be able to put a member, a set-aside member or two, depending upon your population, on the city board that will allow the funds from the state and federal government that flow to the police go to these particular tribal council members that sit on the city council that now have more than $6 million. They may have like 10 times that much to have cars and radios and interaction and the discussions and with the district attorney on policing and investigations, arrest, and how people are going to be treated in our community. That's the most powerful way to do it, because to wait for the churches to do something or someone else to do something, and they don't know what to do. Let's face it, the preachers preach. They don't know what to do politically. So this is the political choice that you have. You have either just to let it go or to make some type of wish that the church would step in, and they won't, because they don't know how. And even if they did step in, they don't know how to step in to community police. Now, I can
Let me say this. On the phone line, y'all, that's Dr. Mustafa Ansari. Y'all can find him on Facebook. But tell him, you all are working with, your group is working with United Nations, and you all are about separatism. And so you feel like that's the solution to fixing all of this, that, you know, we just should separate, correct?
Well, I hated to use that word, because it's not really separatism, because we live in an integrated society. What is the more accurate description of what I'm talking about is tribalism, because under international law, we are an Afro-descendant tribe. That's how we're looked at, because people have different identities. Our identity goes all the way back to our sojourn in this country. And so because of that, we have developed a distinct identity than the white Americans, and that's the problem with this policing, because they understand that they have a separate, distinct identity than us, and they're trained and taught from birth that they are supposed to oppress us and humiliate us and be superior to us. So, and that's the main problem that training cannot overcome. So I'm not talking really about separatism. I'm talking about tribalism, because this is just basic law. This is comes, well, not basic law, but this comes out of the advanced criminal justice discussions in UCLA and in the colleges and different things. I'm talking about really law review articles that really set out the fact that we are distinct people. So when you are distinct people, you can't allow or you become subject to the oppression, and in our case, we have over the years, of another distinct people, and who view us as another a distinction of subhuman people that they are deathly afraid of, even though we don't have arms or different things like that, because they know from their history and what they've done to us over the years, so they figure that we're very angry, should be very angry or very violent towards them, because that's the natural response from someone who has been gotten beaten down and raped and bred and that sort of thing. So knowing that, them knowing that, and we not knowing it as much, we don't understand that there's a remedy that we can take under the law that puts us, that recognizes our own tribe, which is different from separatism. When you have your own tribe in a city, in your area, you control that area. So you control the police, you control what's taught in the schools, you give the business licenses, you control the waste management and every activity of governance in your particular area. When that is done, then the degree of police killings and the degree of poverty goes down tremendously. And the wealth increases tremendously.
Let's see if any of the panel has any questions about the concept that he's talking about. Because one thing you said, and Dr. Fortner talked about this in his class, and we talked about it off in the pre-interview. Dr. Fortner, let's talk about what you said when we talked about their perception of us creates a lot of these situations. And I'm going to let him explain, because he does it a whole lot better than me. What he said is so on point with what you say in your classes.
Yes, but let me address something else before I proceed. Is in social science, we talk about the ideal versus the real. And what the gentleman is speaking about is the ideal. What I speak about is the real. The reality of it, when we talk about what the black church can do or cannot, we already have a model of what happens when institutions come together. It's called the 1960s, and that's when we got a lot of change. So it would be idealistic to say we could separate. It would be idealistic to say we had our own schools. But in reality, as a social scientist, as a historian, as a citizen of this country, I don't think that's going to happen. So we have to look at strategies that are going to be real, strategies that deal with the reality of what is happening. Now, training can be beneficial. Training can be very beneficial. And there is a police officer who I talked in my class about perception, as we talked about, and I talked to them about how the perception. Let me give you a better quick example. This is the short version. American history told or written by a Native American is not going to be the same as American history written by settlers, because they perceive things differently. And what I say to students is that what has happened to black people for centuries is that we have not been able to control the information about us that goes out into mainstream media or in the movies. We've not been able to control the images, and people have perceptions about us. Those perceptions morph into attitudes, and those attitudes govern their behaviors. So what it comes back to is who controls that information in those images. So a good example, a student that I taught who later became a police officer, he tapped into that. He said that his buddy, and this was a white officer, he told me that two white officers, and he said the guy, they stopped the car of African-American boys. And young boys, I think he said they looked to be around in their 20s. And he said when they got back into the car, his partner told him, why is it that my adrenaline flows more when I see that it's a car of African-American? He said, my adrenaline. And my student, who has a bachelor's degree, which means he got a little more education to go along with his training. Right now, it takes about as much training to become a police officer as it does to become a cosmetologist. But this kid got a little more education to go, and he called me and he said, you know what? I explained to him, because he said, this is not a bad guy. But he said it worried the guy that his adrenaline was flowing. And he said, I tapped into what you told us in class about he may be reacting to a perception, because we are the only group, and I'm not knocking what happens in our own pop culture, but there can't be much good that comes out of a pop culture that promotes the idea of being a thug. There's not much good can come out of that. And mainstream media seems to tap into that, because I have a term that I call thugonomics. These companies know that the thug image makes a lot of money, so they don't care about the consequences of that. They're going to put that image out there. But when that image, even in pop culture, in the news, constantly shows that this gangster kind of thing, there is an effect that image has, because people create perceptions. And that could happen in court. That could happen in the classroom. And the reason I talk about interracial coalitions is because you got to have common-minded people who understand exactly what is going on, who spread the word of what is really happening, in the same way that that white student took that information to his white colleague to let him know, we got to get around that. So that is why I say a combination of training, interracial coalition, and these other institutions. So the formula that a lot of people have, and especially police officers, and it can be really damaging, is they have perceptions taken from pop culture or from the way that the term the gentleman was talking about, in the way that we grow up, it's socialization. The way they were socialized, the conversations they have, that affects the way we are perceived, and that perception can down the road affect behavior. Again, the reason I speak about we got to not isolate but interact. Everybody on this call has had an instance when they said they knew somebody and they really had a perception about them. They didn't really know them. What they thought was, I know you, was based on perception. And you have gotten to know that person by working with them or being in a setting where there's interpersonal exchange, and you walk away. This may have even happened when you were younger as a high school kid. You walk away saying, I used to couldn't stand you, but now that I've gotten to know you, you're okay. That was the result of interpersonal exchange. So, again, I still push the idea that we got to figure out a way to make sure that these perceptions that people have of us and the way that these police officers are trained, the young lady talked about psychological. I have talked to so many students. I had a young man who withdrew himself from the academy because he had done 3 tours. And he said he passed the psychological evaluation, but then he realized he had a love affair with killing. And he's like, I don't think I need to be a police. He withdrew himself, but he got past the training. So there's a whole lot that needs to be done because we're not going, police departments are not going anywhere. Separating from society, it's not going to happen. We got to figure out a way how to live in the real, and we got to figure out a way to affect the way these officers are trained. We got to figure out a way to put pressure on systems. We got to figure out a way to make people that we have in position, especially African Americans, be accountable for what needs to be done.
All right,
Terry.
Can I say something before we move on?
Can I go further and expound on what I just said?
Sure. And then Rashonda wants to go. Rashonda wants to go
ahead. Just to piggyback off of what he said was about how perception is given, and I think the media plays a lot, a huge, big deal in how blacks like ourselves are perceived, whether educated, uneducated, whether wealthy, unwealthy, whatever the case may be. I feel like social media and the news and things like that play a huge part in how we perceived. I watched, and for example of that, I watched a movie called The Social Dilemma, and The Social Dilemma was basically about how social media is designed in the IT world to basically manipulate people and how they think. It was saying like it's a lottery on how they guess on what you're going to click on next, and it's steady feeds. And in that documentary, it said that within the first 30 minutes of an incident, and we can use a Tatiana Jefferson's murder as an example. I live up the street, heard about it, went up there. I'm like, what the crap? Okay, within 30 minutes of that, I mean, within, let's just say, a few hours, because it happened mid-morning, and we didn't get word of it till maybe 8 or 9 o'clock that morning before we went up there. They had said that she had a gun, okay? So people ran with that. People ran with it. They say, oh, she had a gun, so she had a reason to be killed. Guess what? Within 2 hours of being off of social media and going back on to Facebook and Instagram, I've seen numerous stories spread saying, oh, well, she had a gun. It was justified. Then when the story came out that, in fact, she was well within reason because she was in her own home, she was licensed to carry, you couldn't debunk what was already put out because the first story that hit the waves is what everybody ran with. And in the Social Dilemma documentary, it says you can put out the story a million times with the truth, but whatever the first 2 or 3 stories is that catch a wave is what people are going to ride with. And that's what happens in the black community. Soon as something go wrong and the media hits with it, and whatever story they put out, which 9 times out of 10, we already know how they're going to do us. I don't care.
Yes.
Tatiana got lucky because she had absolutely no criminal background or anything like that, but you best believe that they dug and dug and dug to try to find something on her. And if it was anything on her, that was the first thing that they were going to publicize versus her being a student, a good aunt, watching her nephew, you know, while being killed or whatever the case may have been. They're going to paint a horrible picture, They're going to dig up your past and put any type of dirt out, and that's what America's going to run with. So, of course, people are going to look at us as bad people.
Gotcha.
Amen.
Was that you, Dr. Ansari, that was wanting to come back in?
Yes, yes. I wanted to explain to everyone that there's a big distinction between social scientists and historians and lawyers. I'm a lawyer. In fact, I'm an international lawyer. And so I don't talk in supposition as to what's real and not real. What I talk about is law. And so what I'm saying is that we can't change lawyer structure, and social scientists and historians, they observe things, but they can't come to a conclusion. They can't come up with a remedy, with a legal remedy. What I spoke about is not a fantasy. It's the law. It's the reality of identity law. The Indians have an identity, and because of that, they have their own educational system. So they change the perception of their children, and they change how people perceive them because they're in a different structure. Lawyers structure things because they want to come up to a remedy. Now, social scientists, historians, not only them, the preachers can talk all day, but don't have the competence to come up with a remedy. So we're talking about how can we structure community policing so that our people can be safe. And so the legal remedy, the United States has signed on to this Convention on Civil and Political Rights, gives us the right to self-determination. So I want to change the language because I think that we don't understand that separation is a very elementary term. It's really self-determination. We have the right to determine our police, to determine our areas, and to control our areas through self-determination. The United States ratified, which means that Congress ratified along with the other. And Carrie explained that correctly. I teach human rights, which comes from the United Nations and the conventions. The United States is a party of the United Nations. They signed the convention, Article 1 on the Convention on Civil and Political Rights, which gives us the right to self-determination. So we have the right to do exactly what I explained. We have the right to elect among ourselves, to be self-determining, and to determine our boundaries, our territorial boundaries, rather to elect an authority over that territory, which is a tribal council. We also have a right to have set aside seats on any city board. This comes from the Declaration on Indigenous Rights, which us as Afro-descendants have been written into. So this is our remedy. We have a remedy that we can put into effect because if we just listen to our social scientists who observe social phenomena, behavior, and psychologists who analyze behavior, and historians who analyze events, that's all we're going to have, and we will never have a solution. What I gave this panel is a solution. I teach lawyers how to do this and deal with gentrification because this is an advanced way to deal with gentrification because now no one can move you out because you have now legal authority over the areas in which you live. What I just explained would increase the wealth of the people in four ways terms because now you control the businesses. It would increase the education of our children who are now educated under a colonial system to be dependent upon them. That's what the education of children. And this is the reason why we talk like this, that it's unreal. We can't do this. No, this is law. And this is the only thing I speak. I speak about the law.
It's getting hard to hear you. Can you come closer to the phone?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So what I speak about is not supposition. It's what we can legally do. Because we're going to be sitting here talking all night for 20 years, and this is what has happened, instead of coming up with a identity structure to do things. Civil rights has failed because of the customary law of the United States. What is customary law? It's the customs of white supremacy. That overcomes any kind of civil rights that we have. This is why we're shot down, because the police are operating on customary law. They're customs that have occurred over the amount of time that we've been here. So we can't train that out of them. We can't psychoanalyze that out of them. This is how they have been educated and trained since they were born. So I can give you a structure. I can structure your community policing. I can structure your election, which is to elect the authority of your areas. I can structure it so that you can have set aside seats on the city council. I can structure it so that you can do that. Your tribal council or your council can get direct state and federal funding for your own police cars, your own radios, your everything that you need to operate to do this. I can structure a collaborative force with the Fort Worth Police. For a police force that will allow us to protect our people. I can structure that. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference between what I do and what is being done right now.
Okay.
I tell you what. Okay.
May I just add, because I'm going to excuse myself from this, but
okay.
I'm just going to end on this. Two of the most influential Americans, two of the most influential African Americans, W.E.B. Du Bois and Dr. Martin Luther King, they were both social scientists. So to say that social scientists cannot affect change, I have no clue what that is all about. I mean, if you look at the history of the country, and you look at the contributions made by ministers, teachers, all of these people who really are boots on the ground, I can't have what they do being disrespected by saying that it doesn't matter and the only people who can truly change this will be people with international law. I really can't engage in that type of exchange. So I'm going to excuse myself. I appreciate being given the opportunity. I will listen in as you continue to discuss it, and I hope everybody will have a good evening. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Fortner, you don't have to leave. We can move on past that topic. We got another call. Wow. Yo, I don't know. Okay, yeah, we're going to move on past that topic.
We can't allow our egos to get involved in the death of our people. We need to structure a way to prevent that. I'm not really trying to disrespect anyone. I'm just trying to give a really clear view between our disciplines. I'm not a social scientist. I may have some social scientists as a witness, as an expert witness. So I'm not disrespecting social scientists. We use them. We use historians. But when we talk about putting together a remedy, then we need to have lawyers to be able to engage with the lawyers in Fort Worth, to be able to engage with their lawyers so that we can come up with a treaty or understanding, an agreement between the city council and our people. And that's law. That's law.
Right. Y'all can agree to disagree. Dr. Fortney, I apologize. I did not expect for this to happen. I'm going to move on. I'm going to take some more calls, Dr. Sorry. We're going to go to 314-381. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
You know, it's funny how people want to separate. But when parents want to have school choice and vouchers where they can separate their kid from traditional education, liberals, mm-hmm. teachers unions, and other pundits are totally, totally against that and will fight them to the T.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how that works.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
you know another yeah. thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
In white communities and white police are so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that when blacks flee criminality, like in Ferguson, and I watched
mm-hmm.
this, Ferguson became 70% black because blacks fled North St. Louis City. Areas like DeVille, Walnut Park, Penrose Park, and others. And they had tough policing in Ferguson because that's what the people wanted. Anytime they got ready to, they could have changed the police department. In the state of Missouri, the Missouri Constitution that goes back to 1875 says that the people of this state have the inherent, sole, and exclusive right to regulate the internal government. When they say internal government, they're not talking about state government. They're talking about those cities that the Constitution allowed to exist, cities, villages, and towns. They can
mm-hmm.
regulate the internal government and police thereof and to alter and abolish their constitution and form of government, whatever they may deem it necessary. So
well,
I don't know what it is.
Wait a minute, let's be clear. Pianki lives near Ferguson, okay? So you know and I know they were killing black people with all those police stops, and they were resulting in tickets, and those tickets were turning into enormous fines. And, you know, it was just a police trap there. So when you say change, that stuff was rooted in that area.
No, it wasn't. Blacks had lived, had commanded. Now, you know one thing you said so far? I live near Ferguson, and I know it. And the other community
mm-hmm.
is too. If you stop
okay.
a car and the car has got four or five safety violations on it, well, you're supposed to ticket them because it's a safety violation and it's violating the lives and safety of the other motorists. If you don't have insurance, that's because in Ferguson, that's all it is in that community, black people.
Okay. Right,
you can stand
right.
there on West Florissant and Chambers Road all day long, and you probably count maybe 10 white driven cars come through there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in Nigeria, who you think the most of the people that's going to be ticketed if they do so? What they going to look like?
Nigeria.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Another point. Mm-hmm. As I said before, after 2014 and all that riding and stuff, and this is the shame part because blacks have been living in that area for a long time, had invested in property value, schools, and so on and so on. They fled. And you know where they fled to? They fled further west across the Missouri River into St. Charles County, which is a majority white and white police. So they can't be fearing the police. They're fearing the people and the actions that they're doing. Now, I say this. This is human beings because human beings do that stuff. You can't have a police department where you say that all the police have to live in one community. Courts have came out and said you can't do that. They tried that in the city of St. Louis, not only with the police department but with the fire department. And the court said you can't do that. And let's say something else. You talk about fear
mm-hmm.
and the whites fearing blacks. I had a teacher at Normandy School, his name is Elaine Woods. Woodson,
mm-hmm.
Elaine Woods. Woodson. He went to Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
She got off the bus, the tour bus, and the kids ran toward her. Well, guess what she doing? These are all black kids. Guess what she done? She turned around and ran back on the bus because she was scared. It wasn't no whites in the bunch of kids. She was afraid. Now, maybe that's natural for people to be afraid when they come upon someone in a different town, different area, and different culture. I don't know. I really can't tell you what she got.
Is that why police are shooting? Are you saying that's why police are shooting black people in the black community because they're fearful?
I think that police, I think that you find a lot, okay, let's take Ferguson. Majority of people in Ferguson that's going to be in contact with the police is going to be what, black, right? Then you got a lot of people that has no respect for authority. They don't have it at the house. It's not in the schools. And, of course, it works out in the public. That's what I see. You know, in Chicago, you don't have in Chicago.
You could start a war.
Well, hang on. In Chicago, through just Wednesday. Well, hey, you let Osari try to get us to separate.
I knew that was setting the wrong thing.
How many people, after he got through talking, there shouldn't be nobody left. They should be packing their bags.
Well, I mean, I have to say something on that note. You said that, I mean, you making it seem like people, like the police only target criminals. Case in point, I don't even have a record, never have one. I was riding with someone who also did not have a record. But guess what? When we got pulled over, and I'm 40 years old, this was 5 years ago. When we got pulled over, I know how to address police. Yes, sir, no, sir. Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Guess what I got? I still got drug out the car, threw on the ground, at gunpoint at that. And so for you to sit and kind of say, like, oh, well, they only target, like, criminals. And it, no. Innocent people are bystanders of the BS that police give us as well. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to
I agree with you, ma'am. I agree with you. Let me get in here before Carrie, who asked me to come on the show, but give me on 2 minutes, and I'm sorry, an hour. Let me make some mention, too. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you done had about three police officers shot by black males, and they was all – one stood over a cop and pumped bullets into him. Came all the way from Kansas or St. Louis. He got captured, and nothing happened to him, not a hair on his head. None of them, matter of fact. In St. Louis, you done had the same thing happen where you have black shoot white police officers, and they captured, don't nothing happen. But but like what you say, you got some bad. We're not denying the bad ones. St. Louis City, out of their budget, 51% goes toward public safety, which includes police officers. Now, that's a lot of money to be spending on public safety in a community that's bleeding population. The school district is down to less than 20,000 students. At one time, it used to be over 100,000. People are fleeing. Either blacks are fleeing.
Thank you. We got to go. And Art, I'm sorry you got me in trouble. You got one panelist to hang up, and you got Bianchi mad at me. Bianchi, we got to go. I'll make it up to you another night. We got to go.
Well, if it's anybody left, it sounds like I hear people packing their bags.
We got to get to another caller. Good night, Bianchi.
We're going to go separate.
He's been knowing me for years. Y'all listen. He ain't messed up. We're going to 817-798. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
I'm sorry. Did you say 798-0296? Are you talking to me?
Yeah, we're talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Good evening. This is Leon Carey, and so good evening to everyone. I came in because I had some other stuff I was taking care of. Good evening, and good evening to apparently whoever's left listening.
I sound like it's just me.
It sounds, you know, I must have missed a pretty good, you know, conversation because go ahead.
You didn't miss anything.
That's attorney your question tonight is.
Oh, Leo, what's up, dog?
Who am I speaking to?
Now, this Reggie Wilson, I've been trying to get in touch with you. Sorry I missed that walk you took down to Austin.
I appreciate that. It's a little bit hard to hear everybody, but I maybe it's my internet tonight, but I appreciate the sentiments on the walk. You know, again, as I've been telling people, that walk was a beginning, not an end. So we're still gathering information and still trying to correct a lot of the legislative proposals that are going on, some of which are straight dog and pony show stuff that really, really have no teeth to them. But with respect to tonight's topic, I'm assuming did someone come on and speak to the meeting that was had last week?
No. Tell us about that.
No, they didn't address that meeting.
No.
Okay. Well, that meeting, of course, was in reference to the stated, you know, when there were some issues of violence in East Fort Worth, and one of the acts led to one of our seniors being unintentionally shot, and so a call was put out to community leaders to address, you know, tonight's topic, that topic being, you know, us stepping up and addressing issues within our community. And there were a lot of people there, and of course, at the end of the day, and I say this to everyone, there is no single magic bullet to any of this. This is kind of like losing weight. The weight didn't get put on overnight, and it's not going to be taken off and removed overnight. And so we have to address these issues from any facet that leads towards equality, civility, and safety. There are a myriad of roads that'll get you to Los Angeles, and you may take I-20 to Interstate 10 to Interstate 8, and somebody else may come across 40, and somebody else may be coming from Seattle. There are just a bunch of different ways, but the goal would still be to get to L.A. Some ways will take longer than others, you know, and some options, although they may seem a bit pie in the sky-ish, you know, it's the old saying that if somebody comes up to you and they're needing help, and you know, you can't give them stock tips if they're hungry. You understand? Mm. You have to address the immediate needs of that person. If that person is in need of food and shelter, it's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You need to address the immediacy of things in order for you to even begin to work on the long-term things. So we need to be addressing and that immediate things and things that we can do now with the summertime coming. You know, we were looking into the different programs that, because when school lets out, we're going to have a bunch of bored kids running around. So we're trying to figure out what type of facilities can be made available, whether it's churches in the communities, to supplement those who can't afford the summer programs through the cities. We're talking about people who have mentoring opportunities to, and people who are willing to train kids in trades, because trades in America are on the rebound, and that's the plumbing, welding, carpentry, masonry, all of those things that as society continues to grow, you know, learning how to read blueprints and AC, all of that, those are a well upper middle class paying jobs. And when you get those kind of jobs lead to home ownership in our communities. You can add a room on, you know, remodel something, increase the property value, own the land, and that is a step in the right direction towards, you know, us as a people getting closer to equality and being in safer neighborhoods. Now,
Well, Attorney,
I'm not trying to.
Can I ask you?
Go ahead.
No, because I wanted to ask you a question because I a lot of people do not know the community in which Attorney Reed lives in. Because I want to put this out here about this camera because I love for other people to give some feedback on this. When we're talking about policing our own communities, over in Como, they wanted to put 68 cameras in Como, correct? Police cameras.
That is correct.
Right?
Yes.
And so how big is Como?
Como is about 130 blocks or so. And it would have equated to about one camera for every two blocks. Now, with respect to, I don't know the data on Ferguson. I don't know the data on St. Louis. I do know the data on Fort Worth. And the census data and the data that Fort Worth uses for its annual racial profiling reports indicate that 60% of people with vehicles in Fort Worth are white, 14% are black, 19% are Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
In every year, without fail, without exception, since 2002, when those reports have started to be generated, African Americans have been disproportionately stopped, typically in the 2 to 3 times our ratio. Whites have never been stopped at their level of representation when it comes to vehicles. So when you take that dynamic and then you say, well, we want to put cameras in your neighborhood, and here's what they're doing with these cameras, because I'm a defense attorney. I'm privy to a lot of information, videos, body cams, stuff like that. The general public isn't. They're using these cameras to actively police people. You pull up to a corner, they say you didn't use your turn signal. Somebody in a bunker downtown radios another cop who pulls you over a mile and a half up the road who wasn't even around and says, hey, I'm pulling you over because you didn't use your turn signal within 100 feet of a stop sign back up there, you know, a mile. What are you talking about? You weren't even there. Oh, well, somebody was watching the camera. Well, if you're doing this to actively police minority neighborhoods, then you darn well better be doing it to police the neighborhoods in the 60th percentile. Because when they pull us over, already in a lower economic neighborhood, and they give us tickets that they know are going to turn into warrant, then they're going to continually use that as the basis to keep pulling us over and stopping us, then that shows a systemic problem. And so we were able to combat that because we asked as a NAC. I had put in an inquiry, a public information request. Where are these cameras located? Because an article said 500 cameras are already around the city. Okay, where are these 500 cameras that are in public view? That means if I can walk down the street and look up and see that camera, it's in public view. It's not a secret. So I'm not asking you to tell me where are the secret cameras at. I'm asking you to tell me where are the cameras at that are in public view so I don't have to crowdsource where they're at. And it turned out that about 60% is what he told me, what the police had to tell me because it was required and asked in a community meeting. 60% are in black neighborhoods or in people of color neighborhoods. Now, you and I know that if cameras were to make stuff so safe, who would have them first?
White people.
They would have them first. And then they would make their way down to our neighborhoods 10, 15 years down the road if they were really going to make people that safe. Well, when I started presenting data in the community meetings and educating our elders began to see, you know what? We need to press pause on these 68 cameras. And 68 cameras ended up going down to there is approximately 20 cameras, and most of those cameras are code enforcement cameras, and they're on the fringes of the neighborhood where people dump things illegally and the other ones, and they haven't really even been put in. So right now there are 8 at the most. There may be 20, and those cameras may be ended up coming out. But all of those cameras are located on the fringes in the dump, in the areas where most of the dumping is going to take place. With police cameras, we limited the police to four.
Let me ask a question since we have two attorneys.
This is what I meant about. This is what I meant about over policing, like the ten squad cars in my little neighborhood. Well, everybody knows about the Christmas roundup. That's when the cops who have not met their quota for issuing tickets, that's when they come out in full force and start issuing a bunch of tickets. And this, you know, what Leon was saying about the cameras, this is what I mean about our community being over-policed.
I agree.
Now,
I agree.
We know about St. Louis County and why only one out of six cops in Ferguson was black, because they hire the white officers 75 miles away. That's what the people were protesting in these little towns where you had majority-minority. Well, the political structure was all white, and they hired nothing but white officers that lived 75 miles away in the little country areas. And as for the idea about tribalism, we've gone through that with with the Republic of New Africa. And if you want to know about the independence, ask the Ogala Sioux. The Ogala Sioux never had a treaty with the United States, but the United States still lords over them through what they call tribal councils. The people still don't have self-determination. So we're not talking about pie and sky ideas. We're talking about Fort Worth and what's being practiced here.
Let me ask a question, since I have such an intelligent panel tonight and callers. And Mr. James, please forgive me for asking this question for you. I wish he'd asked it for himself. Mr. James was there the night of Tatiana Jefferson was killed. He was very close to the scene. Mr. James is being told that he will not be called as a witness because they're saying that he has done so many interviews on television that they don't need to know anything else. They got everything they need. Now, from y'all's perspective, does that even sound right? And is something wrong with our court system for that to even be allowed for the DA to do that?
That is absolutely, I would say, is incorrect. Anything, any statement made outside of a courtroom is hearsay. And if a jury is impaneled and in that courtroom, they have to hear their testimony directly from a witness. If he is the person who made that 911 call, or and I'm assuming, is that who you're talking about, the gentleman who actually made the call?
Yes. Oh, Mr. James is not on the line. Yes, and so
I've met with him, right?
Okay.
And I've met with him. I've stood in his front yard, and you know we've spoken on several occasions. But interviews aren't testimony. Testimony is taken from the stand, and so he is a witness. I would anticipate that he would be called because he is not only just a witness; he's one of the central people who is involved in this matter. Now, I know the two prosecutors who are assigned to the case. I think they're very competent, very capable. If there's going to be any reason why they did not call him in interviews, sometimes, you know, you may say, just like I'll give it to you like this. with the Gospels of Christ. Each disciple saw an event take place. But when each disciple records his events, he leaves out some facts that another disciple may put in. One disciple may say, you know, he may name the hill Golgotha. That's where they took another disciple in his translation in Luke, he may not say the name of it. But and so when it comes to a cross examination, someone may say, well, sir, didn't you say that this is what happened and not that? If it was written one way and not actually what he said, or if he was asked a question a certain way in a telephonic interview and gave a response wherein he was asked a question in court in a different way and gave what might seem or might appear to be a different answer, well, that's when, you know, attorneys may try to exploit the differences. That would be the only caution. But if his truth is the truth, then he's going to be called as a witness, I would anticipate, to tell his truth, because he is part of the elements that led up to her being murdered that night.
I feel like, you know, of course, the DA works hand in hand with the police department and detectives and whatnot. So, in my opinion, I would figure that they wouldn't want to use his testimony because, of course, they're going to do everything they can to protect the Fort Worth Police Department. If Aaron Dean is found guilty, of course, we know another lawsuit is going to come. Actually, the lawsuit has already came. The aunt is already, you know, filing a suit against Fort Worth Police Department. So that's already done. But then if Aaron Dean, even though we know that's two separate cases, of course they're going to try to tie it in. Either they're going to try to pay him off, or if they lose, then of course he's probably not going to get that much time anyway. Me working with a few DAs in civil service, they always seem to have Fort Worth PD back. So why would they want to use Mr. James' testimony? They're going to protect Fort Worth PD to the utmost. It's almost like loyalty, like hand in hand, like the code. So
I would tell you
that
statement.
They want to use it.
I would tell you that being a practicing defense attorney who was at the courthouse today, and I know again. Both of these prosecutors, one of which is a black female, which is one who's one of the most capable prosecutors down there, that statement is incorrect. The DA, when it comes to, and just today, I was in the courtroom, and if you watch Fox News tonight, you'll see me standing next to Russell Wilson and Terry Moore, who prosecuted John Romer for punching Henry Newsom and lying about it to the grand jury and led to his getting sentenced to 5 years just earlier today. And so when it comes time to prosecute bad cops, and there are some who are bad and there are plenty who need to be prosecuted, the DA, we're the ones who end up sitting behind the DA saying, go get them. And that includes the defense bar. And we can tell right off the bat how serious they are about prosecuting somebody by the prosecutors that they assign to the case, because we know the ones who are worth their weight in salt and the ones who ain't worth a plug nickel. These two prosecutors are worth their weight in salt. So we would have to agree to disagree with respect to whether or not, when it comes to the trial of Aaron Dean that's going to take place, whether or not the district attorney's office is going to be putting their best foot forward, I believe they are.
Well, I would hope so.
Let me ask this question. Leon, do you honestly believe they're actually going to have a trial, or do you think they're going to cut a deal?
There you go.
I think they will have a trial. Here's why. You know, the Fort Worth Police Officers Association is bringing in, you know, the big guns. They're bringing in Judge Bob Gill, who was the judge, I believe, in the 213th for a long period of time, who's written criminal defense or criminal practice guides. You know, he, Miles Prissett, have their own form. Tim Choi, Tim worked with Jim Lane on the case with when Courtney shot Gregory Adams in the arm, you know, Jim Lane and Tim Choi. Tim sat second chair with Jim Lane, and again in that case, Jim Lane got the jury to the standard there was reckless, which is a low standard. He got the jury to disregard reckless and just say it was an accident. Well, it was a hung jury, so they never convicted him of negligently or recklessly shooting Gregory in the arm. But they're going to prosecute him. He is not pleading guilty to murder. And here's what a lot of people don't understand with Texas law. In Texas law, the intentional killing of someone starts off as a murder, period. It is a murder. And what you then have to do is find out, was there an exception that would take it off of being murder, i.e. self-defense, self-defense of someone else or something like that. So when you look at Botham Jean, her defense was, you know, mistake of fact. And I mistakenly went into the wrong house, and if I had gone into the right house, I would have had the right to defend myself against an intruder, but I mistakenly went into the wrong house. So my defense is I have that same protection to protect myself against what I thought was an intruder. A jury found that to be unreasonable, so you're still stuck with murder. And so in this case, as soon as he intentionally killed her, he's sitting on a murder. Now the question becomes, does he have an exception? Okay, does he have a self-defense claim? And he's going to, you know, I would anticipate as a defense attorney, I would be saying something like, well, you know, was he snooping around in a place he wasn't supposed to be? Yes, absolutely. Could he have just knocked on the freaking door? Yes, absolutely. Okay, so when she sees, go ahead.
So when
she sees someone in her backyard, does she have a right to defend herself? Yes. Does she have a right to use deadly force to protect property? Yes, in Texas at night. This was night. Okay, so they're going to say, well, what was he supposed to do when he saw someone standing in the window with a gun? Let her shoot him? Does he not have a right to self-defense at that point? And that's going to be the hinging point if you're a juror. If I'm someplace that I ain't got no business being, do I waive my right to self-defense if somebody pulls a gun on me? Are you following me? That is going to be...
Uh-huh. What'd you say, Reggie?
No, I think I'll follow them step by step because that was kind of what we was talking about the other day, talking about the case, is that all the school had to do was just go in there and knock on the door and say, four police, is anybody here? And that would have saved all this. But
absolutely.
But also remember what led to that was when my son-in-law killed Garrett Hull, that's when the police decided to have a shoot to kill a damn the issues later. Issue. And that was something I tried to speak with Chief Fitzgerald about.
When it comes to police training, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I said, are you familiar with that case?
Which case?
Dacian Steptoe. Jared Hall was murdered by Dacian Steptoe in that robbery. You familiar with that one?
I'm not. That's not jumping out at me, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay, this is what happened. My son-in-law, unfortunately, was committing crime. He tried to rob a bar. The police had a little trap set up to try to arrest him. And when they said, police, you're under arrest, Dacian turned around and shot and killed Officer Garrett Hall. And of course, they killed Dacian. So, when they had a little memorial service for Garrett Hull, I went to the service because I wanted to meet with the family and let them know how sorry I was about what happened. Because I felt that things was about to get way out of control, because now that a police officer's been murdered, was going to be open seat. And that's exactly what Chief Fitzgerald said on the podium, is that we have to go back out here in this community and get rid of these scumbags. And that's a quote. That's what he said. So I spoke to him after the speech. I said, well, my name is Reggie Ruffin. Jason Steptoe was my son-in-law. So does that make me one of the scumbags you want to eradicate? But then he wanted to start choking back on his words and everything. And I told him that you're basically giving everyone the red light. I mean, you know, you're giving everybody the red flag. Just go ahead and go out here and just start shooting. And what happened? Eight police shootings, and every last one, the police just started pulling out the gun, started shooting. Fortunately, Tatiana Jefferson became the ninth person that was killed behind that. Because, I feel that Aaron Dean could have just walked into the house. Maybe he felt that it was not a good thing to do because of what happened with the Bolton John shooting. But at the end of the day, that's what should have happened.
He
should have went in.
He can't just walk in. He could have absolutely knocked on the door because he was not alone. If he was alone, he could have taken up a position at a safe distance and waited for backup. One person stand at a safe distance, another person knock on the door from the side to see. You know, there are just a bunch of different ways that it could have been handled. But Aaron Dean told you what he joined the police department for in his recruiting video. He said, I want adventure. And so he was seeking adventure. And when people want adventure, they want you to run. They want to snoop and poop. They want to sneak. They don't want to just walk up to the door, have somebody come and say, yeah, everything is fine. I just wanted some air to come in. You understand what I'm saying? Because that neighborhood where she lived, where they had just moved into a new house, that neighborhood was safe enough for her to leave her door open at night. Okay, because she knows that neighborhood and the people in it. He doesn't know that neighborhood and the people in it, so he views that as a threat or as a danger. Okay, and that's part of the issue with them not knowing our communities. What she thought was a safe place for her to be in her new home in the neighborhood in which she knew everybody. Okay, this police officer did not, but a greater portion of that problem, and y'all can go and check this, just Google Fort Worth Police Department racial profiling reports. On the left-hand side, you'll also see the use of force reports. And even this year's, in almost all of the use of force reports on there, the vast, over 50% of that pie, it's a pie graph. You can look at it. Don't take my word. Please don't take my word. Go look. A pie graph shows you that over 50% of the uses of force committed by Fort Worth Police Department officers come from officers with 5 years or less experience, and it's always been that way. Well, if it's always been that way, you don't have an incident. You have a trend. And as a city council member, as a police chief, you have a duty to go and address that trend. Why are over 50% of the use of force incidents coming from inexperienced cops? When you didn't do anything to address it when you saw it in 2015, that you didn't do nothing to address it in 2016, and when you saw it in 2016, you didn't address it in 2017, 17 you saw it, 18 you didn't, well then you are complicit in the death of Sister Jefferson because you failed to address the issue because Aaron Dean had 3 years experience and he was an adventure seeker when he went and killed that woman that night. Are you following me? So they don't have clean hands because they haven't addressed the problems. But the perception of our communities is certainly different. And Chief Fitzgerald used that, you know, called us scumbags. We have enough problems as it is. I recommend a book. It's very succinct. The Assassination of the Black Male Image by Earl Ofari Hutchison. It talks about how black males have been vilified throughout history and our communities, therefore, are scary places where you can't leave your door open at night, you know, without there being an issue. and that's just not the case.
Leon, I
yes.
still have a problem with Aaron Dean's body cam looking through the bullet hole in the window and seeing the gun and the what was the proximity of the gun? Why was it still on the table, on the coffee table beside the bed?
If you're asking me, I'll tell you this. I don't believe he saw a gun. I believe, let me back up a second. I do believe he yelled, drop the weapon or something of that nature. Okay.
No, it says, show me your hand.
Show me your hand. Okay. Now, if he's saying show, now, because at first, and I'll tell you this, in my heart, I don't believe that he could see that she had a gun. Because typically if someone's going to hold a gun, they're going to hold it, you know, down while they're looking out the windows. They're looking out, peeping with the left hand, looking through the blinds, the right hand, or have the gun. You don't have a gun up by your face. I don't know. I can't tell you that he did actually see it in the window. But when they went inside, yes, you know, she lawfully had a weapon. And the funny thing that the NRA is usually sending advocates all over the place in situations like this, but nobody from the NRA came down there to say Sister Jefferson had a right to be where she was with her
same
weapon.
Same thing.
But as far as him seeing that weapon, if she's in her house and she don't know who he is, she never said he's a police officer or anything like that, and you're snooping around her backyard just because you say drop a weapon, I'm not dropping mine. You understand?
What,
and so, go ahead.
His body cam showed a pistol, but it was on a table. So, did he shoot her and she lay the gun down on the coffee table? It doesn't
here's
make
what,
sense to me.
Right. Here's what likely happened. Again, let's assume that, because in my opinion, I don't think he probably saw the gun. I think they probably found the gun once they went inside and she was there on the floor, either already deceased or dying. And at that point, they moved the gun away from her and hopefully mm-hmm. began to treat her. And so they would then move the weapon away from the person and put the weapon in a location where they deemed it out of harm's, you know, out of the way so that no one can cause them harm. But I don't believe he saw that weapon outside the door. I think that when they went inside, they saw the gun, and that gave them their excuse to protect him. But I can't be certain of that. But once they got inside and they saw her on the ground with a gun nearby, they would have moved that weapon away from her. That would have been standard protocol.
Yeah,
let me
well,
take
it
one more
wouldn't
call.
Have showed up on his body cam.
Yeah.
It should have.
Let me take 972-987. Good evening, you're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
All right. Good evening to you, Carrie, and good evening to you, your guests on tonight, your panel tonight. I just have a quick observation, and I just want everybody to be mindful and listen to what I'm saying. He who controls the information controls the narrative. He
right.
who controls the information controls the narrative. Always remember, the police, they always have a narrative. The media
right.
always works. The media works hand in hand with the police. Everything in America that's wrong, that's bad, that's anything you think of bad in America is wrong, it's black. You know what I'm saying? We are the poster child for everything that's wrong in America. It's black. So the media and the police, and not we don't have. I have to always put a disclaimer. I don't like disclaimer. Put a disclaimer. We do not have an issue with law enforcement in our communities. We only have an issue with those individuals who do not follow that oath and who disrespect their badge, disrespect people, and just run roughshod through our community. But the narrative, you always, every time they come out before the media always gives the law enforcement's narrative first before anything comes out. We don't why not just let them get everything together and then put everything out? But it's always the police's narrative. And then if it's somebody black, you know, the media always do their check to see if this person has a background. But let's run up to the ground, whether the person is innocent of a crime or not. Let's run up to the ground. Let's remind America of who they really are. And I'm going to say this last point. Y'all recall when Brother Bolton had his situation, right? When Brother Bolton had his situation, you remember what the media did to him the following days, how they tried to assassinate his character? Remember all the hearsay and all the rumors that were going around about a relationship and about him having a ballistic vest and about marijuana and blah, blah, blah. The media is very detrimental to black lives. Bad media. Let me say this. Let me just put it in perspective. Bad media. Bad media. Because we need media. Bad media. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Thank you, Sister Carrie.
I agree. I have one question. You know, is the state of Texas, we know it's a stand your ground state, but is it a stand your ground state where you have a duty to retreat, or is it a stand your ground state where you don't have a duty to retreat?
That's what's known as definite distinction. You know what it is.
Because, see, I'm trying to figure out, if you're in your own home and you're minding your own business, and this is a stand your own, if this happens to be a stand your ground state where you don't have a duty to retreat, then if somebody's in your backyard that's not supposed to be there, if you got a gun, you have a right to defend yourself, whether it's a police officer or not. If you're not committing a crime and you're in your own home, so do we have a duty to retreat if we think there's a prowler in the backyard?
And on your personal property, you do not have a duty to retreat. It used to be within the home is where you did not have a duty to retreat, but now it extends to your property. You don't have to retreat from your property. So, but anywhere else that's not your property, you know, we're not one of those states where you can just do what you want to do. That limit. Is limited by your property.
Mm-hmm. Well, then if we're talking about
Well, I was going to add to that. I was just going to say, remember the episode of Good Times when James told JJ, this is your home, son. You don't break a rule from nobody. Well, that's what the rules are, stand your ground. At home, you don't break a rule from no one. And I will say this, if you know who the other person is, that can be an issue for you. Yes, we got this. So they always going to be police have the right, no matter what. And that's the mountain you have to get over anytime you're involved in a case like this. Think about what would happen if Tatiana just had a shot and killed Aaron Dean. What the story would have been then? What would the story be like if Bolton John was a South police officer? He went in there, but Geiger's house and shot and killed her, and then hide behind her. I thought it was my house.
We saw how it turned out with the Breonna Taylor case. Now let's catch one more phone call. 254-346. Good evening. You're in Let's Talk Fort Worth. 254-346.
How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I am doing great. Well, I just came in on the show, and I do apologize if I didn't catch the topic.
Okay. The topic is, should we police our own community?
Well, with this law that has just been passed by Texas Senate, you better get rid of the police your own community when you allow...
What do you mean, the...
Hello? Say that again?
Are you referring to the gun law?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Something ain't right about that.
Oh, right. It's going to become the Wild Wild West.
Yes. And when I was just talking to a constituent just being out of Michigan, they said the same thing, and this is nothing but an experiment. This is a great experiment on Texas. This is a great experiment on Texas.
Is that what they said?
I know it is an experiment, because any time that you can give a felon the right to purchase a firearm without having to be criminally checked, or without having to have a license or a registration or have a criminal background check, you think this
that's
is
not
okay?
The law. That's not the law.
It might not be the law, but guess what, though? In less than 2-3 days, I know for a fact with my own eyes, I have seen two convicted felons go down to the pawn shop and purchase a gun without a background check or either a registration. So you can call it
well,
it's not the law all you want to,
down,
but
let's
it's actually,
the
it does actually happen.
I'm not telling you that people, that felons and gang members don't get access to weapons. What I'm telling you
is no,
that person
man, they
gets,
went down,
gets caught.
They went down there to the pawn shop. Two dudes that I knew that was convicted felon went down to the pawn shop just the other day. Just, matter of fact, 2 days ago, went to the pawn shop. And I was in there because I was looking for a computer. And with these guys, but I was looking for a computer. And they
okay,
saw something that they liked. And they saw guns.
Okay.
And both of them walked at that pawn shop, convicted felons, with two guns, and nobody ain't asked no questions. All they had to do was pay money.
Okay, well, to piggyback off of that, I mean, let's be realistic. Being from the hood, I'm pretty sure that if I was the old person I used to be, it's a few pawn shops I can go to with the right amount of money and say, hey, this is what kind of firearm that I want. As long as my money long, I'm going to get whatever I want. So, of course, you have to understand that some of these pawn shops are private owned, and they're going to run it how they want to. So, of course, it's easy for a felon to go into a pawn shop and get a gun. But if you come to me and say they went to a gun show or went to an actual gun authorized dealer and they was a felon and got one, then I might take it serious. But, of course, everybody have access to guns, point blank period. It's easy. If I took $500-$600 and said I want to go down there and get me a .22, an average .22 run what? About $129? But I'm giving you what, 3-4 times the value of it? Yeah, I'm going to be able to get it with or without a license. Money talks.
You say go to the gun show or don't go to the gun show?
Yeah, the laws don't stop people from getting
it. ID numbers.
Okay. I'm sorry, what did you say?
All you need is just an ID number or name or whatever to just put them behind. But when they turn that into auction, they go by what they sit in, and that covers them. But yeah, get the right place, right amount of money for anything. I mean,
that's my point.
Right, but that constitutional carry law does not apply to felons. In fact, it increased the penalties for felons with a weapon. It increased the penalties to a minimum 5 years, instead of it being typically a felon in possession of a weapon is a third degree felony, punishable 2 to 10 and up to a $10,000 fine. Well, now with the new constitutional carry law, if you're a felon caught with a weapon, now your minimum is 5. You know, and
yep.
so again, that law does not apply to felons. Are there felons who are going to get weapons? Absolutely. That's what everybody's talking about, the so-called bad guy with a gun. You know, if you're a gang member, you're not supposed to. Go ahead.
We got to get out of here tonight. Listen, y'all, it's been another great show. Thank you for all that were part of the panel tonight. Eddie Griffin, Dr. Fortner, we got to bring you back. I apologize. Mustafa, you having a disagreement. Typically, I like y'all to agree to disagree, but hopefully we can bring you back at another time. Rashonda May, thank you for coming. And also, welcome for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you, Attorney Leon Reed, for chiming in on the topic tonight. Okay, y'all, until next time, same bad time, same bad channel. We'll see you then. Good night.
Bless you.